kind of animal and every kind of creature. A final touch. Noah sacrificed some of the animals and birds that he had just saved from the flood as an offering to God. At Göbekli Tepe, archaeologists have found the butchered bones of many of the animal species depicted on the megalithic pillars. Cities from before the flood. It has long been recognized by scholars that the biblical flood narrative is not original to the Old Testament, but was borrowed from a much earlier source. Indeed, a source dating back to the oldest true civilization so far acknowledged by archaeology, ancient Sumer, in Mesopotamia, which arose in the 5th millennium BC, flourished during the 4th and 3rd millennia BC, and survived into the 2nd millennium BC. The two earliest surviving written versions of this global flood myth can be seen today at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, and in the private Schøyen collection in Norway. Both are written in cuneiform characters in the Sumerian language, and both have come down to us as fragments rather than complete texts. Of the two, however, it is the University of Pennsylvania tablet, found during excavations of the Sumerian city of Nippur, located on the Euphrates 200 kilometers south of the modern city of Baghdad, that is the most complete, consisting of the lower third of what was once a six-column tablet of baked clay, and dated to the 17th century BC. The Schøyen tablet, though less of it survives, is a little older, dated to the 19th to the 18th centuries BC, repeats some of the lines of the Pennsylvania fragment, and adds a few new details not found elsewhere. What rare and precious things these little broken slabs of baked mud are, and what a tale they have to tell. When I first read that tale, I was instantly intrigued, because it contains explicit references to the existence of five antediluvian cities which, we are informed, were swallowed up by the waters of the flood. The first 37 lines of the University of Pennsylvania tablet are missing, so we do not know how the story begins, but at the point where we enter it, the flood is still far in the future. We hear about the creation of human beings, animals, and plants. Then another break of 37 lines occurs, after which we find that we have jumped forward in time, to an epoch of high civilization. We learn that in this epoch, before the flood, kingship was lowered from heaven. Then comes the reference to the foundation of Sumer's antediluvian cities by an unnamed ruler or a god. After the lofty crown and the throne of kingship had been lowered from heaven, he perfected the rites and the exalted divine laws, founded the five cities in pure places, called their names, apportioned them as cult centers. The first of these cities, Eridu, the second, Bad Tibira, the third, Larak, the fourth, Sipar, the fifth, Shurupak. The preserver of the seed of mankind. When we rejoin the narrative after a third 37-line lacuna, the scene has changed bewilderingly. Although the flood is still in the future, the foundation of the five antediluvian cities is now far in the past. It is apparent from the context that in the intervening period, the city's inhabitants have behaved in such a way as to incur divine displeasure, and that a convocation of the gods has been called to punish mankind with the terrible instrument of an earth-destroying flood. At the moment where we pick up the story again, a few of the gods are dissenting from this decision and expressing their unhappiness and dissatisfaction with it. Without preamble, a man called Zisudra is then introduced, the Sumerian archetype of the biblical patriarch Noah. The text describes him as a pious, God-fearing king, and allows us to understand that one of the gods has taken pity on him. The name of this god has not survived in the University of Pennsylvania tablet, but the Schøyen fragment gives us a clue when it reveals that Zisudra was not only a king, but also a priest of the god Enki. This god, of whom we'll hear more later, tells Zisudra, "Take my word, give ear to my instructions. A flood will sweep over the cult centers to destroy the seed of mankind is the decision, the word of the assembly of gods." A text break of 40 lines follows, which scholars deduce, from the many later recensions of the same myth, must have continued with detailed instructions to Zisudra to build a giant boat and thus save himself from destruction. When the story resumes, the cataclysm has already begun. All the windstorms, exceedingly powerful, attacked as one. At the same time, the flood swept over the cult centers. For 7 days and 7 nights, the flood swept over the land, and the huge boat was tossed about by the windstorms on the great waters. Throughout the cataclysm, the skies remain dark. Then on the 8th day, the sun breaks through the clouds, and the rains and raging storms cease. Opening the window of his survival ship, Zisudra looks out over a world that has changed forever and sacrifices an ox and a sheep to the gods. An infuriating lacuna of 39 lines follows, presumably telling us about the place where Zisudra makes landfall and the steps that he takes thereafter. When we pick up the story again, near the end of the text, we find him in the presence of the high gods of the Sumerian pantheon, Anu and Enlil, who have repented of their earlier decision to wipe mankind entirely from the face of the earth, and are now so grateful to Zisudra for building his ark and surviving the flood, that they decide to make him immortal. Life like a god they gave him. Breath eternal like a god they brought down for him. Zisudra the king, the preserver of the name of vegetation and of the seed of mankind. The final 39 lines are missing. The Seven Sages. The late Professor Samuel Noah Kramer, one of the great authorities on ancient Sumer, observed that there are tantalizing obscurities and uncertainties in this oldest surviving written version of the worldwide tradition of the flood. What there can be no doubt about at all, however, is that the tablet speaks of an urban civilization that existed before the flood and provides us with the names of its sacred cities: Eridu, Bad-Tibira, Larak, Sippar, Shurippak. These cities, we are told, quite specifically, were swallowed up in the deluge. Moreover, long after Sumer itself had ceased to exist, rich traditions concerning the five cities, the antediluvian epoch, and the flood survived in Mesopotamia and were repeated by the cultures of Akkad, Assyria, and Babylon that later rose to prominence almost down to Christian times. Indeed, it is fair to say that the traditional history of this region, as it was told in antiquity, is very clearly divided into two different periods, before and after the flood, and that both periods were regarded by the peoples of the region as absolutely factual and real. We saw in Chapter 1 how the Mesopotamian traditions not only preserve memories of antediluvian cities, but also of an antediluvian civilizing hero called Oannes, and the brotherhood of seven sages, the seven Apkallu, who are said to have supported his civilizing mission. As the reader will recall, these sages are often depicted in the surviving art of the region as bearded men holding a peculiar kind of bag or bucket, but sometimes they are also shown as therianthropes, part bird and part human in form. As I dug deeper, going back and carefully rereading the accounts of the Babylonian priest Berossos that I had first touched upon when I was researching Fingerprints of the Gods, I was reminded that Oannes and the Apkallu sages were also sometimes depicted in a different therianthropic form, in this case part fish, part human. Each of them was paired as a counselor to an antediluvian king, and they were renowned for their wisdom in affairs of state and for their skills as architects, builders, and engineers. Berossos compiled his history from the temple archives of Babylon, reputed to have contained public records that had been preserved for over 150,000 years. He has passed on to us a description of Oannes as a monster or a creature. However, what Berossos has to say is surely more suggestive of a man wearing some sort of fish costume, in short, some sort of disguise. The monster, Berossos tells us, had the whole body of a fish, But underneath, and attached to the head of the fish, there was another head, human, and joined to the tail of the fish, feet like those of a man, and it had a human voice. At the end of the day, this monster, Oannes, went back to the sea and spent the night. It was amphibious, able to live both on land and in the sea. Later, other monsters similar to Oannes appeared. Bearing in mind that the curious containers carried by Oannes and the Apkallu sages are also depicted on one of the megalithic pillars at Göbekli Tepe, and as we saw in Chapter 1, as far afield as ancient Mexico as well, what are we to make of all this? The mystery deepens when we follow the Mesopotamian traditions further. In summary, Oannes and the Brotherhood of Apkallu sages are depicted as tutoring mankind for many thousands of years. It is during this long passage of time that the five antediluvian cities arise, the centers of a great civilization, and that kingship is lowered from heaven. Prior to the first appearance of Oannes, Berossos says, the people of Mesopotamia lived in a lawless manner, like the beasts of the field. Berossos wrote his history sometime between 290 and 278 BC, but only fragments of it have come down to us, preserved as quotations and summaries in the works of other writers, such as Syncellus and Eusebius. However, scholars recognize that what has been transmitted to us in this way does accurately reflect much more ancient Mesopotamian traditions, inscribed on cuneiform tablets going back to the very earliest times. For example, the name Oannes, which has perhaps been distorted by the writers who passed it on to us, turns out to be derived from Uan Adapa in cuneiform, often abbreviated simply to Adapa or to Uana, with the Adapa element originally being a title meaning, appropriately for a sage, wise. It is said in the ancient Mesopotamian inscriptions that Uana accomplishes the plans of heaven and earth. Others of the group of antediluvian sages include U-Anaduga, who is endowed with comprehensive understanding, and An-Enlilada, described as the conjurer of the city of Eridu. This last point, that the seven antediluvian sages were conjurers, sorcerers, warlocks, magicians, is driven home repeatedly in the cuneiform texts. But at the same time, associated with their magical abilities are obviously practical, technological, or even scientific skills. Thus, they were masters of the chemical recipes. They were medical doctors. They were carpenters, stone cutters, metal workers, and goldsmiths. And they laid the foundations of cities. Indeed, in later times, all crafts used in royal building and renovation projects were attributed to knowledge that had originated with the antediluvian sages. As Amar Annus of the University of Tartu, Estonia, summarizes in a detailed study, the period before the deluge was one of revelation in the Mesopotamian mythology, when the basis of all later knowledge was laid down. The antediluvian sages were culture heroes who brought the arts of civilization to the land. During the time that follows this period, nothing new is invented. The original revelation is only transmitted and unfolded. Oannes and the other sages taught all the foundations of civilization to antediluvian humankind. The cuneiform tablets of ancient Mesopotamia also shed at least some light on the containers that the Apkallu sages are so often depicted as holding. They are referred to as bandudu, buckets, and are presumed to have held holy water. Very often, too, as the reader will recall from Chapter 1, the sage holds in his other hand a cone-like object. These are referred to in the inscriptions as mulilu, meaning purifiers. In the same scenes, the sages frequently appear in conjunction with a stylized tree, or sometimes with the figure of a king, or sometimes both. No specific textual references to the tree have survived, but the general assumption of scholars is that it must be a sacred tree, while many believe it represents the tree of life, and that it symbolizes both the divine world order and the king who functioned as its earthly administrator. The conclusion, therefore, is that we are looking at a magically protective rite, a benediction, an anointing. By sprinkling the tree with holy water, the sages imparted to it their own sanctity, upheld the cosmic harmony, and thus ensured the correct functioning of the plans of heaven and earth. The seven Apkallus were believed to have been created by Enki. Enki is his Sumerian name, the Akkadians called him Ea. Revealed in the Shoyen tablet as Zisudra's patron, the great god of the subterranean freshwater ocean known as the Abzu. Enki's particular attributes, in addition to his connection to this watery realm, were wisdom, magic, and the arts and crafts of civilization, so it is appropriate that the sages would be amongst his creatures, and that they would frequently be symbolized as fish. The form of the fish Apkallu, as one scholar notes, is linked with the secrets that dwell in the deep, and its never-closing, ever-watchful eyes lend it an omniscient sagacity. Thanks to the advice and teachings of these extraordinary sages, these magicians of the wisdom god Enki, we learn from the cuneiform texts that human civilization achieved rapid technological and scientific advances and entered a phase of exceptional splendor and plenty, the Golden Age before the Flood. All seemed to be for the best, in the best of all possible worlds. But as the millennia passed, mankind fell out of harmony with the universe and with the deities, and with one deity in particular, the great Enlil, described as the king, supreme lord, father and creator, and perhaps giving more sense of his personality, as a raging storm. Although the sky god Anu was technically ranked first in the Sumerian pantheon, he was usually a rather remote, impotent figure. Enlil was his second in command, but in fact responsible for most executive decisions. Enki, nominated in some texts as Enlil's younger brother, was ranked third. The Sumerian flood story, as we've seen, has many gaps, but other tablets, such as those containing the Epic of Gilgamesh, arguably the most famous of all surviving Mesopotamian texts, fill in the details and leave us in no doubt of Enlil's role. In those days, the world teemed, the people multiplied, the world bellowed like a wild bull, and the great god was aroused by the clamor. Enlil heard the clamor, and he said to the gods in council, "The uproar of mankind is intolerable, and sleep is no longer possible by reason of the Babel." So the gods agreed to exterminate mankind. We know what happened next. The god Enki, in addition to the Shoyen tablet, other later texts also confirm it was he, intervened to warn Zisudra that the instrument of extermination, a great life-destroying flood, was about to be unleashed. Berossos, who calls Zisudra Zisuthros, gives us the next chapter of the story. Enki appeared to Zisuthros in a dream and revealed that mankind would be destroyed by a great flood. He then ordered him to bury together all the tablets, the first, the middle, and the last, and hide them in Sippar, the city of the sun. Then he was to build a boat and board it with his family and his best friends. He was to provision it with food and drink and also take on board wild animals and birds and all four-footed animals. Then, when all was prepared, he was to make ready to sail. He did not stop working until the ship was built. Its length was 5 stades. 3,000 feet or 914 meters, and its breadth was 2 stades, 1,200 feet or 366 meters. He boarded the finished ship, equipped for everything as he had been commanded, with his wife, children, and closest friends. The surviving fragments of Berossus do not tell us of the experience of the flood, but the Epic of Gilgamesh does, putting the words into the mouth of Zisudra Zisuthros himself. "For 6 days and nights the wind blew. Torrent and tempest and flood overwhelmed the world. Tempest and flood raged together like warring hosts. When the 7th day dawned, the storm from the south subsided. The sea grew calm. The flood was stilled. I looked at the face of the world, and there was silence. The surface of the sea stretched as flat as a rooftop. All mankind had returned to clay. I opened a hatch, and light fell on my face.